From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week, Gen presents a special podcast that serves as a preview to the Biotechnology Industry Organization's annual international convention, which will be held in San Diego in June. One of the major themes of the BioConference will be the globalization of biotechnology, and our podcast focuses on that topic. John Sterling, Gen's editor-in-chief, interviews four conference committee co-chairs: Gregory Lucier, chairman and CEO of Invitrogen, and Dr. Catherine Mackey, senior vice president of Pfizer La Jolla, lead the conference steering committee. Stephen Ferrillo, partner at Goodwin Procter, and Dr. Alan Lewis, president and CEO of Novocell, head the program committee. The panel discusses how a globalized bioindustry impacts each of their businesses. They also explore several other key globalization issues. Now, here's John Sterling.
Before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to talk to our listeners about the increasingly global nature of biotechnology. My first question, then, is how has the globalization of the bioindustry affected your particular company? Let's begin with Dr. Mackey.
Sure. Well, Pfizer, of course, is a global company. We have we do business in over 100 countries around the world. We have R&D facilities in America, North America, Asia, and Europe. So, this is not—it's nothing new for us.
Greg Lucier.
Invitrogen participates directly in 70 countries around the world. And the greatest phenomena we're seeing is the general migration of the biotech industry from the West to the East. Some of our fastest growing markets today, where we supply sophisticated biological reagents, are in India, China, and Korea. And each country in and of themselves has different dynamics of why they're growing quickly. But generally, what underscores or underlies the growth in each of these countries is, first, the government is strongly supporting the research basis in their universities. And then secondly, with respect to at least we see in India and now more increasingly China, Western companies are putting more and more of their operations there or putting out to contract some of their work that they were doing internally to contract research organizations to do the work for them that are located in India and China. So, again, importantly, we see the general phenomena that we've seen in other industries of West moving to East, and these countries that we've seen have great growth in industries like electronics are now having great growth in the biotechnology industry.
I know, Jen, we certainly see that in a lot of the news stories we cover and a lot of the news releases we get, so that certainly is a key trend. Dr. Lewis?
Yeah, so we're not quite as global as Pfizer or Invitrogen. We are located in California and Georgia, but we work in the area of stem cell research, which has huge interest globally, and there are great scientists around the world that we can collaborate with. And I've actually just come back from Singapore to a BioAsia conference where it was very clear that, as Greg was pointing out, the Indian research scientists, the Chinese scientists, and people from that region, they're cutting edge, and, of course, to mingle with those people is of huge benefit to us. We all speak the same language of science, and, obviously for us to be able to collaborate with these people can only help our programs in the regenerative medicine space.
And in the legal world, Stephen Ferrillo, what are you seeing in terms of globalization?
Well, I would simply say, we started off with Pfizer and Invitrogen, which are both global companies. But I want to, in this instance, talk about, I work for life science companies of all sizes. But let's talk, at the other end of the spectrum, a startup life science company. I mean, a startup life science company from its very beginnings has to think globally. I mean, that's just a fact of life. So you start off, first of all, with the protection of IP. Your IP strategy has to be a global strategy. And I see that in every startup I deal with. What countries are we going to protect ourselves in? What can we do? So I think that's step number one. I mean, step number two, in terms of, let's just assume it's a U.S. company and the technology is U.S. I mean, just to make that assumption. you know, those companies are going to look also in terms of opportunities to have chemistry work done, a formulation work done, or sources to manufacture their molecules or their biologic, whatever it may be. They're looking on a worldwide basis in terms of, a global basis in terms of where the best sources may be. A lot of our early stage companies in San Diego, for example, are having their chemistry done in China. You know, next stage is, of course, you know, when companies are engaged in clinical trials. In virtually every instance that I know of now, clinical trials are being done on a multi-country basis around the world for all kinds of reasons, the availability of patients, availability of naive patients, and so forth and so on. So your clinical trial and your regulatory strategy also has to be global. And then, of course, you get to the point of commercialization. So, I mean, globalization is just a fact of life. It's an essential part of what we are and what we do from the very earliest stage company.
Now, I know as a journalist, the Internet has totally changed my life. I go back to when we only had a telephone and we got mail deliveries two or three times a day. And now, just like everybody else, so being inundated with emails, and we do a lot of searching for news on the Internet. Greg Lucier, what impact is the web having on the globalization of biotech?
Well, I can speak to our own experience. At Invitrogen, about 60% of our revenues now in the United States and about 45% globally are actually being done through the Internet. And so while about 5 years ago our business was very much of a direct sales model, today it more mimics an Amazon.com. And I think we couldn't be more surprised than perhaps anyone else that this phenomenon would happen and happen so quickly. But as you do more analysis on it, at least in our business where we're selling a technology for research and development, it makes sense that scientists would like to browse on the web, find out more information about their research, and then ultimately purchase on the web the supplies that they need. And so the Internet is really making science, which already was a very global business in that science is the same if it's in Chicago, Paris, or Beijing, even more of a tightly connected global business today, at least is how we see it. So it's impacting our business quite directly because today we have an incredibly large web team. We are hiring people that have that type of marketing sophistication to understand how to do very fast search technology. And so, again, our whole business model has been changed by the web, and it's making our business ever more global because it extends the reach.
And Dr. Lewis, how's the web affecting NovaCell?
Well, you know, we're typically one of the smaller biotech companies, you know, 30 to 40 people, and obviously having access to such a powerhouse as web information, access to all sorts of, whether it's reagents, people, intellectual property, which you can get from universities, a small company like ours, we can compete with the big boys because we can get access to the same information. You don't need an army of people to access information. It's phenomenal. I think we're obviously benefit also from the fact that all scientists today are literate on the web, and so our 35 people are all accessing information and can communicate around the world. So we feel that we can be players and compete with some of the major companies in terms of information flow.
Stephen Ferrillo, the web?
I would just reiterate what people said. I mean, the power of the web is access to information and, you know, making it available democratically to large companies and small. And I think just hastening the process of development, access to technology, access to people, access to, you know, information, which is critical to, you know, to drug development.
Dr. Mackey, how has the web changed business at Pfizer?
Well, probably the biggest impact is the fact that you can buy fake Viagra on the Internet these days. That's awesome. I think Greg said 60% of his revenues are on the Internet, and I think probably 40% of our lost revenues are due to the Internet. But that aside, I agree that the fact that science is the basis of our industry, scientists are the engine that drive our industry, and the fact that information is so readily accessible is just a tremendous boost. And also, I would add that our ability to recruit people around the world, I think, has improved. It's just made it much easier for us to advertise positions and to receive applications from people all over the world. So as a result, I think the talent pool is growing.
Dr. Lewis, this next question, I want to start with you. How are varying governmental policies, such as restrictions on stem cell research, affecting where and how research is done?
Well, obviously, it's a very germane question for me and my company, Novacell, because that's exactly what we work on. Clearly, we're fortunate that we work in California, where the local citizens in Proposition 71 have granted a very large research support to this kind of research. And I think it's unfortunate that current administration obviously has been somewhat negative to supporting human embryonic research, and it has had an impact on this kind of research in North America in general. I think it's also allowed other countries around the world to realize that they can compete with us. In Europe in particular, monies are being spent locally in places like the UK and Sweden. There are lots of consortiums that work in this field. And so I think the climate for investment in this space has been somewhat impacted because clearly we're not getting as much research done in the universities in this field as we perhaps should be. And hopefully with the new administration, there'll be new plans for the future. We rely on the universities to provide us with a lot of the intellectual property and ideas so that the small companies can exploit them. And therefore, I think we've been somewhat starved of support over the last several years. But thankfully, being in California, we've benefited. And I think there are other states throughout the nation who have had the similar policies whereby people like New York State, New Jersey, Connecticut, have created funds to support this important research enterprise.
Stephen Ferrello, from your vantage point, looking at different government policies and impacting biotech?
Well, I think the critical issue is the level of government funding for basic research. And I think that's the critical issue that we need to look at. We do need the government and government entities to fund basic research. And to the extent that, that has pretty much remained level or has been going down, that is a big problem in terms of the future of healthcare, because that basic research is expensive, and that's where the funding has to come from.
Dr. Mackey, Pfizer's all over the world. What are you seeing in terms of different governments and how it's impacting maybe what Pfizer wants to do in certain parts?
Certainly the biggest issue is price controls for us, and intellectual property would be number two. But I believe we'll get to that a little bit later. But those two issues really have a huge impact on where we do research and where we do our business, and they will also ultimately have a huge impact on the vitality of our business long term.
Greg Lucier? I would build on the earlier comments from Stephen and Alan about the government funding for basic research. If you look at the funding over the last 7 years for the National Institute of Health, which is really the bellwether institution for biomedical research in the United States, and also I think it's fair to say in the world, the funding has essentially been flat on a real dollar basis. And then when you add to that these restrictions around stem cell research, I think it has really almost paralyzed the level of progress that we could have made coming off the doubling of the National Institute of Health in the prior years to the current administration. And it's a shame because I think we've seen some enormous breakthroughs in science that could have been capitalized to a greater extent. And to Stephen's point, I think we've lost some time to really tackle diseases that are going to be absolutely crushing in terms of the cost to our society as the baby boomers age. I mean, for example, we've lost 7 years where we could have, with basic research funding from the government, compounded then with private enterprise funding, tackled Alzheimer's to a greater extent. So, I remain hopeful that we have a more enlightened policy towards funding basic research at the NIH, which also then will lead to funding at the university level because they grant the money out, and it will overall allow the United States to really keep its lead in the biotechnology industry, which right now I think it remains, but it is being threatened because of just the way we've approached this business in the last few years.
Okay, we've already talked on globalization, and a number of you have mentioned China and India. And in the coming years, many experts agree that China and India will be world leaders in the development of new technologies. But the intellectual property realm remains opaque, with radical differences in approach taken by both countries. And also there's evolving IP norms and confusion across the board for local players and multinational companies alike. Stephen Ferrello, how can biotech companies eager to advance science responsibly partner with researchers in these young, exceptionally promising markets especially with the IP issue in mind.
It seems to me that the situation is there is that, you know, my advice to clients and advice of our IP lawyers to clients is you've got to be careful. You've got to be cautious. And I think that we can't be assured that there's going to be an adequate level of protection of intellectual property in India and China. I think we are making progress. There are a lot of pressures with the WTO and others to make that happen. But I think there is some risk here. One approach is, I've been involved in these discussions, is look, you know, we understand that there may be some risk in terms of our ability to protect our intellectual property within those countries. But at the same time, it's value for us to take advantage of development of intellectual property from those countries and then protecting that intellectual property elsewhere in the world. So I think that's what you're going to see a strategy for a lot of companies.
Dr. Mackey, you mentioned before one of the things Pfizer is concerned about is IP issues in some of these countries like China and India. What more can you say about that?
Yeah, I really believe that this issue is going to be resolved over time, that as India and China begin to develop their own IP, then the laws will evolve following that. As soon as they have something to protect, they will recognize the intellectual property of others. And so I think the issue that we have now is it's short term. You know, we have to be careful. We are shifting some R&D to those countries, but we're being very careful with the IP, but I'm hopeful for the future.
Greg Lucier, Invitrogen has a huge amount of technology and instrumentation and other methodologies. When you go to China, India, you know, what's your attitude towards dealing with the IP issue?
Well, I think like my other colleagues that do business in China, India, we have been cautious in terms of just how much cutting-edge technology we place into China and India for the very reasons being discussed here, that the kind of nascent infrastructure around intellectual property protection causes a company like ours to be cautious. Now, having said that, I think the other way to approach this, though, is that both of these countries, China and India, are going to become generators of IP in the not-too-distant future. And so instead of a company like ours being cautious about what we put there, I think we're going to have to be more aggressive about what we get there. And I think that's why I would just second Kitty's comment that I think they're going to get their overall policies around IP straightened out, much more like we see here in Western countries. And in the end, I think companies like ours or Pfizer's or really any biotech company is going to have to be a far more attuned and aggressive about what kind of technologies they're finding over there to build their businesses. So I'm pretty hopeful about the future here.
Dr. Lewis?
Yeah, I don't have a lot more to add other than, you know, stress the word caution. I think the good news is, obviously, that there's a reverse brain drain. A lot of the good Chinese and Indian scientists are going back to their own countries, and hopefully they take back with them the importance of intellectual property, and, you know, they're obviously probably easier people to deal with, perhaps, than some of the original folks that had less concern about that. But right now, I think the key word is just caution.
Now, risk-reduced business models in the life science industry have become increasingly popular among risk-averse investors. Some companies rely heavily on in-licensing to bring successful drugs from overseas to the U.S. Other companies are selectively building drug discovery and development capabilities and outsourcing non-core capabilities only when needed. Dr. Mackey, what other strategic decisions do biotech companies, life science companies need to make to add value, mitigate risk, and bring treatments for life-threatening diseases to patients faster and cheaper than the traditional life science company?
We are certainly have a lot of activity in in-licensing, not only drug candidates, but also new technologies. We're also doing a number of collaborative projects with universities and biotechs around the world. We're also considering, this is something new for us, we're doing it, we're out-licensing some of our compounds that look promising but don't have a strategic fit for Pfizer. So that's something new that we're doing. And I think that, you know, another area is to make maximum use of biomarkers and other technology to reduce the chances of late-phase clinical failures, which it's very, very costly when that happens. So, you know, it's a risky business. There's no way we're going to take the risk out of this life science business. It's high risk, and that's the industry.
Greg Lucier, in terms of mitigating risk and adding value, what non-confidential information can you tell us that Invitrogen uses?
Well, maybe, we license technology from all over the world. We have a fairly large licensing team that gets stationed at a lot of the universities around the world to look for things that are emerging out of the university benchtops. At the same time, maybe I could be a little bit more philosophical because part of our business is understanding what the end customer health is and direction is. And so, you know, we're very attuned to what's going to happen with the large pharmaceutical segment, what's going to happen with the biotech segment. And I think you're seeing an amazing evolution take place right now, which is that without being anything in particular but more general, you're just going to continue to see a devolution of the larger pharmaceutical industry to where they can get the advantages of scale that they have and not have to pay for the advantages of scale that they're not getting. And, you know, what I mean by that is just simply we see ever more money going into smaller, newer biotech startups, which tend to be more flexible in their cost structure and have the ability to take much higher risk. And that you'll see the larger pharmaceutical industry really move more towards getting the advantages of scale where it exists, clinical trials, distribution, sales, and marketing. And I think that just simply means you're going to see a lot more fragmentation take place, a lot more startups, and a lot of those startups won't be in the United States anymore. And so I think, again, this becomes much more of a global business in the next 10 years than just a U.S. European business that it has been in the last 10 years.
Dr. Lewis, you run a small and young company. What do you do to add value, mitigate risk, to try to get your products to market?
Well, I'd just like to make a comment. First of all, obviously, innovation is the core of our industry, and it's somewhat unfortunate that the investors of today tend to be a bit more risk-averse, and they'd rather invest in a company that has a phase two compound, which may be acquired from a Pfizer or some other major pharmaceutical company in Korea or Japan, than in truly novel, innovative technology, which is the future of healthcare, clearly. Stem cell research is not being a darling of the investors because it is longer term. And so we have to be very careful about how we spend our money, and we have to seek financing from unusual sources, whether it's from philanthropic groups like the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, people like that, that are willing to invest in the gap between early-stage technology and where investors are showing some interest. So, you know, if you're in that space of high innovation, which is not necessarily close to clinical entry or certainly product development, you have to be extremely careful of how you spend your money and, you know, have to be quite creative about where you find it. So there are a lot of technologies that need to be supported. There's a huge amount of innovation across the world today, and it's never been a more exciting time for discovery. I think the issue is how can we support it financially? And the point that was made a little while ago by Stephen, we need the U.S. Government to step up and continue support, and hopefully at least in the academic community. And some of the academic work, I think, is progressing more into an applied technology where they're obviously filling almost biotech company-like vehicles at the moment.
Stephen Furlow, how do you advise your life science clients who are considering different risk-reduced business models?
Well, I agree with what, you know, everybody has said. I think that if we're looking at, you know, biotechnology companies, smaller startup companies, I think that they have to be realistic. And I think a very important point that Greg Lucier made, they are great centers for, you know, now we're beyond basic research, we're to applied research for early stage development, for taking things along, for taking greater risk, for being creative in terms of that process. I think one of the problems that's gone on in biotech in the last few years is the view that the companies can do that and also sustain the amount of risk and the amount of money that it takes and develop and have the expertise that it takes to take products all the way, okay? And I think that in most instances is a mistake. And in fact, it is better, you know, at that point when one gets into more advanced clinical trials, to basically partner with larger biotechnologies or pharmaceutical companies who have the experience, who have the financial resources, and so forth, to carry that through. I just think it. I think what Greg says is exactly right, is think about more segmentation in terms of where can we most effectively and most efficiently do this part of the development process and do that rather than, you know, everybody trying to do everything with different levels of efficiency. And I think that's going to be critical.
That's a wonderful, perfect lead into my next question, because recent years have seen a sharp increase in global biotech and pharmaceutical companies partnering with smaller companies to collaborate much earlier in the development process. Dr. Mackey, can you talk about some proactive strategies and tactics to improve the odds of success for both parties entering into an alliance or collaboration?
I think, you know, this has been a huge part of Pfizer's strategy for many, many years, and it's even been increasing more over the last year or two. And in my experience, it's really the soft things that make it work. It's the relationship. Once you've written the agreement, that goes in the drawer, and you don't pull it out until you're in trouble. And you know when you're sitting across from someone and you've pulled the agreement out and you're pointing to words on the page that things are going south quickly. So it's really important that it's a good relationship, that it's a win-win relationship, and it's based on the science. It's very important that the scientists in the labs are, you know, doing the clinical studies or whatever, that the technical folks are very well aligned. And when that happens, it can be very successful. And we have more successes than not. And, again, I think strategic alignment and a very strong relationship are the real keys. And it doesn't hurt at all. In fact, I think it helps to be geographically close. We have a number of collaborations here locally in San Diego, and they really work out beautifully. And I think that a lot of the reason for that is because there is proximity. So even though it's a global business, there's nothing like having your collaborators working across the street from you.
Greg Lucier, what does it take to make a collaboration work from your point of view?
Well, I would agree completely with the comments that Kitty has made. I think proximity certainly does help. A lot of studies have proven that. I think an alignment of goals certainly helps. And then lastly, I think you have to have a culture of candor, because in the end, strategic alliances and collaborations all rest on trust. And so you've got to have an organizational mindset that is, we're going to be candid, we're going to be transparent, and we're going to treat extensions of our organization like they were part of our organization. And so maybe most of the work actually is, even before you get into one of these alliances, that you're building the right culture ahead of it, that the people have confidence to be candid and be transparent when they have to work with third parties.
Dr. Lewis?
They're very good points Greg and Kitty made. I think, you know, certainly for a small company to attract Pfizer or Invitrogen to collaborate with, I think they have to see us as honest, trustworthy. Obviously, there's a lot of hype in our industry, and we have to be cautious about not overhyping what we do and what we plan to, because these people are very smart. So I think honesty, trust, and respect are really important areas. You know, I tend to agree that obviously it's easier to collaborate with somebody who's local and who culture is somewhat similar to you, but actually I've always found that collaborating internationally is exciting. You learn a lot from people in different locations. I've dealt in the past with Swiss companies, Dutch companies, Japanese and Koreans, and you know, I think generally it's a great learning experience for the small company, and they pick up all sorts of different tips, different ways that things are done. And, you know, clearly we always think in the United States we know how to do it best, but you can actually learn from other nationalities and other countries as well.
And Stephen Ferrillo, what do you think it takes to make successful collaborations?
Well, I think I just want to go back to a point you made. The comment you made about, you know, companies trying to collaborate much earlier in the development process, in fact, it's a pendulum here. And I think you would argue that for the last 5 or 6 years, the pressure in biotech companies is to do that later, with the concept of holding on to value. It's a point I made earlier. I think that pendulum is now sort of swinging the other way, because people realize how expensive it is and how risky it is. But then to get to your point, I would point to four things in the process. I think you've got to know your partner. Okay, I'm going to talk about the biotechnology side. I mean, you really have to sort of be picky. Is this the right partner for you, you know, culturally and in other ways? I think you then need to know where your program fits into their portfolio. That is critical. Is this something which is in their core expertise and they're trying to fill a gap? Do they want a backup program? Is it a new area? You need to understand that in order to really get a sense of whether or not it makes sense and what, you know, what protection you need. I think you need, in that process, you need to have good advisors. You need good lawyers, and you need others who can really help you, have experience negotiating these, know the pitfalls, and can give you good advice. And then I think probably most important is what Kitty said, which is it's all about the relationship. You need to have a good relationship. And, you know, most of the times these agreements have all this formal structure in terms of a, you know, a joint development committee or a joint collaboration committee, whatever it may be called. But the important thing is to have a process in which the parties can collaborate. And it's sort of, I thought an important point that Kitty made as well. I mean, the documentation is important, but if the collaboration is working, no one will ever bother to look at the documentation. When people go back and look at the contract, it's because there's problems. If the collaboration is working, no one ever goes back and looks at the legal work. And I would just make another point about proximity. You know, again, I don't think proximity matters. So it does make it easier. But, you know, it's very interesting. I did a collaboration about a year and a half ago between an Israeli company with a Japanese pharmaceutical company, and I just had a meeting with my client, which is the Israeli company, and we're talking about how phenomenally well that collaboration is working. Okay? Again, sort of people would say, well, Israeli and Japanese, that's, you know, bad reputations out there, but it was a perfect example where the two parties really got to know one another. The transaction really made strategic sense for both of them. They've got key people on both sides working on it, and it's an important collaboration for both of them, and it's working beautifully.
And another very clear example of the globalization of the industry. My final question to the panel, in addition to some of the topics we've just discussed, what else does the biotechnology industry need to do to ensure that it continues to function successfully on a global scale, just like the relationship Stephen Furlow was talking about? Greg, let's start with you.
I come back to a point Alan made that at the core of the biotechnology business is innovation. And I think this industry has to continue to be the most innovative industry in the world. And I think its leadership has to make sure it is absolutely supporting all aspects of innovation for the industry to be successful. And that ranges from, you know, enlightened government policies to robust capital markets to, obviously an appropriate legal framework for intellectual property. So, you know, in my view, again, it's all about innovation, and it's about the leadership of the industry helping to define what we need to make sure the innovation happens.
Dr. Lewis?
Well, I certainly endorse what Greg said. The other area is certainly the financing of our industry. I go back to that. I'm not sure that bio or major organizations could do much about it, but we need to show success to the investors out there so they can see that this is a very, very important area for the future of healthcare, and we need them to invest in us because the small companies are always cash-starved. They have more ideas than you had hot dinners, and the trouble is they just don't have the financial resources to support their efforts. So we do need to continue to show success. I think we've seen in the last year or so there have been very few drugs approved at the FDA is one example. A number of them are certainly biotech-type drugs, but we need to improve our performance so that we can show that this is an area that the investors that are out there that don't know much about biotechnology think first and foremost about this industry as a very important area for the future, not only of their own bank accounts, but certainly of the healthcare in general.
Steve? Stephen Ferrillo, what does the industry need to do to continue to grow globally?
Well, I think it's important. I think it's what Alan was saying. We need to make sure that we get our message out and what we're about, which is innovation and improving human life. And my concern is that we get tainted, you know, with contributing to the high cost of healthcare, okay, which clearly is an issue, okay? And what we need to control the message is we're improving human life, and if, you know, our objectives are to, over time, is to decrease the cost of healthcare by improving human life. And I think controlling the message is critical. Another thing that concerns me right now is all of this publicity about biofuels and its impact on the price of food, okay? And I'm concerned that this industry may well get tainted with that. But again, what we need to get out the message is that what's going on in this industry very actively is new innovations to find the ways to make biofuel more efficient and not to adversely impact the supply of foodstuffs. But if we don't get that message out there in a clear and effective way, I think we're going to be tainted with being creators of the problems that we're really prepared to solve and address.
Dr. Mackey, again, representing a global company, what does biotechnology industry, farm industry need to keep doing to grow and succeed all over the world?
I agree that the key point and message is that the basis of our industry, the basis of what we do is innovate. And if we are successful in innovation in life science, the result is going to be the increased health of people around the world and the decreased cost of attaining that health. But what people don't understand is that currently the free market system in the United States is footing the bill for that innovation. So it's a very delicate situation, and it could collapse. It could collapse, and it's very, very delicate. So it's very important that people understand the basis of it. The second thing is that because innovation is the basis of the industry, protection of intellectual property is critical. We've talked about that. But I see light at the end of the tunnel on that one. I really believe that as other countries become innovators, that intellectual property protection will follow. And then finally, you know, harmonized industry standards across the globe will help simplify our business and allow us to apply more of our resources to the science so that we can innovate.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.